I cannot believe my ears. So I can go now, I say. Mumtaz spits. You did not come easily, she says. You cannot easily go. I don't understand. You can go home. She pauses, picks a fleck of betel leaf off her tongue, examines it. I try to slow the pounding of my heart at the mention of the word home. Mumtaz flicks the bit of leaf into the air and continues. As soon as you've worked off the 20,000 rupees I paid for you. But I have seen her record book with its entry of 10,000 rupees. I know this 20,000 price is a lie. Somehow, of all the things that have been done to me, this outrage is the worst. I haven't cried, not one tear, since that first night with the fish lips man. But now tears surge up in my eyes. I blink them back and lift my chin. But what, she says. She pulls the leather strap out from under her skirt and slaps it against her open palm. I bow my head. From now on, Mumtaz says, you will join the other girls downstairs each night. You will share a bedroom and be free to walk the house. I stare straight ahead. Mumtaz comes close and takes my chin in her hand. But if you try to run away, she says, I will grind hot chilies and put them in your private parts. I shudder, cup my hands over myself and nod. Now hurry up, she says as she walks out. I need this room. New Girl. I am gathering up my bowl and my bundle when the aging bird girl comes in. With her is another girl, a much younger girl. She is wearing a bright yellow dress and clutching a bundle of rough homespun clothes in her arms. I move toward the door with the halting steps of an old woman. It has been a lifetime, it seems, since I was outside this room. I attempt a first step into the hallway, then another, and watch as the new girl enters my old room with tentative steps, as if she is clenching her feet inside her new shoes, like a poor, frightened bat clinging to a branch. What is normal? The aging bird girl says I am to go to the kitchen to join the other girls for the midday meal. How odd it is, then, after all these days of dreaming to be free, that my feet will not obey. Come on, she says. Then she pinches my ear and drags me into the hall. The strangeness of walking, moving more than a few paces to the window and back, makes the journey of a dozen steps feel like a million. And the hallway, a stretch of bare floor and cracked walls, seems to me wonderful, new and foreign and vast and strange and painfully bright. When I finally reach the end of the hall, I see a kitchen. Girls in loud colored dresses are calling out to each other, some in city language, some in my native tongue, all of them shouting to be heard over the wail of a music machine. They bare their teeth as they laugh, shove handfuls of rice into painted mouths. A fat, toothless woman stirs a vat of greasy stew while a naked child crawls at her feet, and the air is thick with the smells of spices and cooking oil, perfume and cigarette smoke. It is all suddenly too much. I sink to the floor, wincing at the tenderness between my thighs. Then Shahana is at my side with a steaming bowl of rice. I eat, but do not taste it. I open my mouth to thank her, to try to tell her how odd it is to be with people again, but I can't find any words. When I finished my rice, she helps me to my feet, then says I must come watch TV with everyone else. It's fun, she says. You'll see. When we get to the TV room, the frowning girl is pushing the button. The box comes to life, just like before. Strange words appear on the glass, and loud, happy music plays. The girls cheer. It's the Bold and the Beautiful, says Shahana. It's from America. It's our favorite show. Inside the TV, a little pink-skinned man is talking to a woman with hair the color of straw. She raises her hand to slap him across the face, but he catches her wrist in his grip and stops her. Then, without warning, they are kissing. The Happiness House girls clap and cheer and cackle like hens. The tiny pink-skinned TV man and woman are strange to me. But these flesh and blood girls are, to me, stranger still. How they can eat and laugh and carry on as normal when soon the men will come is so perplexing that while they laugh, I fight back tears. In my new room, there are posters of gods and movie stars on the walls, an electric sun hanging from the middle of the ceiling, a palm frond machine that stirs the air, a hole in the floor privy, iron bars on the windows, and four rope beds separated by old sheets that hang from the ceiling. "You draw the sheet around your bed when you have a customer," Shahana tells me. Six of us share a room. The half-frowning girl, whose name is Anita, a coughing woman named Pushpa, and her two children. One of the children is a toddler, who's crawling around on the floor dragging an empty plastic bottle on a string. The other, Shahana says, is a boy of 8. She points to the half-frowning girl. "Anita," she says, "is from our country." I place my palms together at my heart and say hello to her in our language. She looks over at me briefly, then goes back to pasting a movie star picture above her bed. I cannot tell from her crooked face if she's smiling or frowning, or both, or neither. The coughing woman, Pushpa, came to work for Mumtaz when her husband died. She's pretty, with dusky skin and almond eyes, but she is so thin her collarbones poke out of her dress like the twigs of the neem tree. As Shahana is speaking, Pushpa is seized with a bout of coughing that racks her entire body. When the coughing subsides, she spits into a handkerchief, sighs heavily, then curls up on her bed with her face toward the wall. The little girl tugs on Pushpa's braid and cries, "Mama! Mama!" But Pushpa doesn't answer. Meeting the David Beckham boy. In the middle of the afternoon, a boy of about 8 comes in and flings a backpack in the corner. He has hair that sticks up like the tassels on a cornstalk and knees as knobby as a baby goat's. He gives Pushpa a kiss on the cheek and tickles baby Gina under her chin. He notices me and points to his shirt. It has the number 23 on the back. "David Beckham," he says. I do not understand these words, but it is clear that this David Beckham boy is very proud of his shirt. Shahana says it is time for us to put on our makeup. Pushpa rises wearily, gives the baby a bottle, and puts her on a little bedroll under her cot. The David Beckham boy grabs a paper kite and runs off. If I could speak his language, I would ask him if the night air in the city smells like the night air on the mountain, like rain clouds and jasmine and possibility. Everything I need to know now. While Anita and Pushpa stand in front of the mirror, painting their faces, Shahana explains everything to me. "Before, when you are in the locked room," Shahana says, "Mumtaz sent the customers to you. Now, if you want to pay off your debt, you must do what it takes to make them choose you. Tell the customers that you are 12, she says, "or Mumtaz will beat you senseless." "Do whatever the customer asks of you," Shahana says. "Otherwise, he will beat you senseless. Then he will do whatever he likes and leave without paying. Always wash yourself with a wet rag after the man is finished," Pushpa says. "This will keep you from getting a disease." "If a customer likes you, he may give you a sweet," she says. "You must eat it right away, or Mumtaz will take it and eat it herself. If a customer likes you, he may give you a tip. Hide it when no one can see so that you will have enough to buy yourself a cup of tea each day. Once a month," Pushpa says, "a government woman comes to the back door with a basket of condoms. Take a handful and hide them under your mattress, but do not let Shilpa, the aging bird girl, see you. She is Mumtaz's spy." "The Americans will try to trick you into running away," says Anita. "Don't be fooled. They will shame you and make you walk naked through the streets. If an old man is at the door, bat your eyelashes and act the part of a little girl, says Pushpa. He will pay extra for this. If Mumtaz brings you one of her important friends, bat your eyelashes and act the part of a little girl, says Shahana. He will pay nothing. There are special things you need to know about how to use your shawl, she says. Flick the ends of your shawl in a come closer gesture, and you'll bring the shy men to your bed, the ones who'll slip an extra coin into your hand before they go. Draw your shawl to your chin, bend your neck like a peacock. This will bring the older men to your bed, the ones who'll leave a sweet on your pillow. Press your shawl to your nose with the back of your hand, Pushpa says, when you must bring a dirty man to your bed. He will leave nothing but his smell, the stink of sweat and hair oil and liquor and man. But you can use your shawl to block the worst of it. Anita turns away from the mirror, transformed from a crooked-faced country girl into a tiger-eyed city woman. There is another way to use a shawl, she says. I cannot tell from her always frowning face if she is being kind or cruel. That new girl, the one in your old room, she says. Yesterday morning, Mumtaz found her hanging from the rafters. Pretending. Her coughing is so bad today that Pushpa cannot get out of bed, so we take turns playing with baby Gina, tickling her, cooing to her, bouncing her on our knees. It is peaceful, until Anita and the cook begin pinching each other's ears over whose turn it is to hold the baby. In the midst of their fighting, the baby begins to wail. Pushpa rises wearily from her cot and takes Gina in her arms. You do not remember, she whispers to her little girl, but we used to have a proper home. She opens her blouse and puts the child to her breast, but it is to no avail. There is no nourishment left in Pushpa's withered body, and again the baby begins to cry. Gina is not the only baby here. Several of the women have children. They dote on them, going even deeper into debt with Mumtaz to buy them fresh clothes for school, hair ribbons and sneakers. The others, the ones without children, treat them like pets, buying them sweets from the street boy when one of their good customers gives them a tip. I ask Shahana why this is so. We all need to pretend, she says. If we did not pretend, how would we live? But why does Mumtaz go along with this? Only Mumtaz does not pretend, she says. She knows that once the women have children, they cannot leave. They will do whatever she asks, or be thrown out in the street. I ask Shahana why the women don't get the shots that will keep the babies from coming. She looks at me like I'm mad. All the girls want babies, she says. It's our only family here. And so the children of Happiness House go off to school in the mornings and come home in the afternoons and do their homework. They play tag in the alleyway, eat sweet cakes and watch TV. But in the evening, it is harder to pretend. As soon as dark falls, the bigger ones go up to the roof. They fly homemade paper kites until they are too tired to stand, daring to come down to sleep only late at night after the men have finally gone. The younger ones, like Gina, are given special medicine so they can sleep under the bed while their mothers are with customers. Morning comes early for the children at Happiness House, and they beg for more sleep with dazed and cloudy eyes. It takes a great deal of coaxing to get them dressed in their school clothes to begin another day of pretending. The customers. They are old, young, dirty, clean, tall, short, dark, light, bearded, smooth, fat, thin. They are all the same. Most of them are from the city. A few are from my home country. One day a customer addressed his friend in my language as they left.
How was yours? He said. Was she good?
It was great, the other one said. I wish I could do it again.
Me too, said the first one. If only I had another 30 rupees.
30 rupees. That is the price of a bottle of Coca-Cola at Bajaisita store. That is what he paid for me. Mathematics. In the village school, we were taught to add, subtract, multiply and divide. The teacher gave us difficult problems, asking us to figure out how many baskets of rice a family would have to sell to buy a new water buffalo, or how many lengths of fabric a mother would need to make a vest and pants for her husband and still have enough for a dress for her baby. I would chew on the ends of my braids while my mind whirred, desperate to come up with the answer that would spread a smile on her soft moon face. Here I do a different set of calculations. If I bring a half dozen men to my room each night and each man pays Mumtaz 30 rupees, I am 180 rupees closer each day to going back home. If I work for 100 days more, I should have nearly enough to pay back the 20,000 rupees I owe to Mumtaz. Then Shahana teaches me city subtraction. Half of what the men pay goes to Mumtaz, she says. Then you must take away 80 rupees for what Mumtaz charges you for your daily rice and dal. Another 100 a week for renting you a bed and pillow. And 500 for the shot the dirty hands doctor gives us once a month, so that we won't become pregnant. She also warns me, Mumtaz will bury you alive if she sees your little book of figures. I do the calculations and realize I am already buried alive. Monica. There is one girl here who gets the most customers. She is not the prettiest among us. She has a face like a fox and pointy grey teeth, but she is the boldest. While the rest of us wait for the men to point in our direction, Monica trains her hungry eyes on them the minute they walk in the door. She does not bat her eyelashes and act the little girl. She preens and struts and twines her arms around the men like a thirsty vine. One night I am alone with Monica. She is studying one of her beloved movie magazines, posing and puckering her lips like the woman on the page in front of her. I can teach you some tricks, she says to me. Tricks to make the customers pay more. I am afraid of this thirsty vine woman. I look at my hands folded in my lap and see nothing. You think you are better than me, she says. Too good to learn my tricks. I am too afraid to even shake my head no. Ha! She laughs mirthlessly, tossing her hair over her shoulder with a shake of her head. I've earned nearly enough to pay down my debt, she says. In another month, I'll be on my way home. I try to take in this idea that Monica will soon be free when a man comes into the room. He has city shoes on his feet and a gold chain around his neck. In an instant, Monica is at his side, winding her arms around him like a snake. And then they are gone, and I am alone to consider an odd and somewhat sour feeling, disappointment that the man did not choose me. An ordinary boy. I have been watching the David Beckham boy, although I do not let on. I know that the first thing he does when he comes home from school is to kiss Pushpa and tickle his baby sister. I know that he sticks his tongue out when he is concentrating on his homework. I know that Anita saves her bread for him, since she cannot chew on her bedside. I know that he has two favorite television shows, one where men kick a black and white ball around a giant green putty field, and another where people try to guess the right answers to difficult questions so they can win 1 million rupees. And I know that he plays along with the millionaire show, because I saw him whispering the answers under his breath. I know that he keeps his belongings in a tin trunk under his bed. And I know what's in there. A rusty key, an empty bottle of hair oil, a plastic flower, and 3 gold buttons, because I peeked inside when he was at school one day. I know from all this watching that he is just an ordinary boy. But sometimes I find myself hating him. I hate him for having school books and playmates. For having a mother who combs his hair on the mornings she's feeling well enough. And for having the freedom to come and go as he pleases. But sometimes I hate myself for hating him, simply because he is an ordinary boy. What is missing now? I no longer notice the smell of the indoor privy. and I long ago stopped feeling the blows of Mumtaz's strap. But today, when I buried my face in my bundle of clothes from home, there was no hearth smoke in the folds of my skirt, no crisp Himalayan night air in my shawl. I have been frugal with myself, not daring to unwrap the bundle more than once a day for fear that it would lose its magic. But today, it became just a rag skirt and a tattered shawl. Stealing from the David Beckham boy. It seems that the David Beckham boy runs a business here. In the afternoons, he runs errands. The good-earning girls, the ones who are allowed to keep their tips, give him a list of what they want and send him out to the stores. I have seen him come back with movie magazines for Monica and Coca-Cola for Shilpa. Sometimes he just gets a smeary lipstick kiss on the cheek, but sometimes he gets a few coins for his troubles. At night, he works for their customers. They yell for him, and he runs to the corner to get them liquor or cigarettes. Sometimes he gets nothing more than a pat on the head, and sometimes, if he takes too long, a slap across the face. But sometimes he gets a rupee or two. When he thinks no one is looking, he hides his earnings in his little tin trunk. In the afternoons, when he is out playing tag with his school chums or running his errand business, I steal from the David Beckham boy. I do not take his money, though. I steal something better. While the other girls are downstairs watching the TV, I take his brightly colored storybook and make it mine. I do not understand the words inside, and the pictures are queer and otherworldly. But at least for a few minutes, I pretend I am in school with Geeta and my soft, moon-faced teacher, and I am the number one girl in class again. Understanding Anita. I ask Shahana why Anita is always frowning. She is angry all the time, I say, even when the bold and the beautiful is on TV. Anita escaped once, Shahana says. When the gundas found her, they beat her with a metal pipe. I don't know this word, gunda. The gundas are men who work for Mumtaz, she says. If you try to escape, they will hunt you. If they cut you, they will beat you. If you get a disease, they will throw you out in the street. If you try to get back in, they will beat you. I ask Shahana what happened to Anita. The gunda smashed her cheek and her jaw. Now one side of her face is dead. She could not smile, even if she had a reason to. Remote control. Shahana has explained that there is a box Anita uses to operate the TV. If she pushes one button, the people inside get louder. If she pushes another, they get quiet. Sometimes, if Mumtaz has a headache, Anita pushes another button, and the TV people make no noise at all. The most important button is the red one. This one can make the TV people appear or disappear. Sometimes I pretend that what goes on at night when the customers are here is not something that is happening to me. I pretend it is a TV show that I am watching from far, far away. I pretend I have a button I press to make everything go quiet, and another one that makes me disappear. Caught. One afternoon, I linger too long in my make-believe school, and the David Beckham boy catches me poring over his storybook. I drop the book to the floor and wait for him to pull my hair or rap my knuckles. But he just cocks his head to one side and stares at me. He steps close and stoops to pick up the book. He holds it out in my direction. But I turn my back to him and flee the room, pounding the floor with my heels as I go. I hate him more than ever now. For catching me at my make-believe game. For seeing that I want his life for my own. And for the pity in his eyes as he offered to share it with me. Police. Tonight I saw a curious thing. Usually the men give their money to Mumtaz. What I saw tonight as I came downstairs was Mumtaz handing a fat roll of rupee notes to a man. He was dressed all in tan, like the man at the border, and he had a gun on his hip. While the man was counting his money, Shilpa, the aging bird girl who spies for Mumtaz, spotted me and chased me away. "Is that man a gunda?" I ask Shahana. "He's worse," she says. "He's a policeman." I don't understand. "Policemen are supposed to stop people like Mumtaz from selling girls," she says. But she gives this one money each week and he looks the other way. I don't understand this city. It is full of so many bad people, even the people who are supposed to be good. No ordinary boy, after all. My new custom is to wait by the window each afternoon so that I can see the David Beckham boy coming home from school. That way I can put his book back in its hiding place before he arrives. What I usually see first is whatever he is kicking ahead of him, a lemon rind or a rotten onion from the trash heap. He pretends it is a ball, like the black and white one on the TV show he likes so much. Today, when I see him, he has had the good fortune to find a rotten melon. Melons seem to be his favorite, since they make a wonderful mess when they strike the curb. He's sticking his tongue out ever so slightly, though he does when he is concentrating on his math, as he nudges the melon in and out of the ruts in the road. And so he doesn't see the older boys, the ones who chase the pariah dogs with stones, waiting across the street from Happiness House. I do not understand what they say to him, but they are smiling and tugging at the hem of his David Beckham shirt. He offers them an eager smile and shows them how he can balance the melon on the tip of his toe. They seem to be impressed, at least for a moment. Then they are pinching his ear and jabbing at his David Beckham shirt. I cannot understand what they say, but I know the word they hurl at him again and again. It is a dirty word, one the customers yell when they are drunk or angry. They are calling his armor a whore. The David Beckham boy looks furtively toward the front door, where Pushpa waits for him on the days she feels well enough. I duck inside, but not before I see him stuff his hands in his pants pockets and walk away, leaving that sweet, rotten melon abandoned by the curb. Something else I know about the David Beckham boy. I know that lately, when he bends to kiss his ama each afternoon, he lingers longer than he used to. I know that he is checking for a fever. I know, because I overheard Mumtaz telling Pushpa that if the fever comes back, they will all be out on the street. Yes. I am sitting on my bed, adding yesterday's profits to the tally in my notebook, when the David Beckham boy comes in. My old yellow pencil is nothing but a stub, and I slip it up my sleeve so this boy who goes to a proper school and does his work with a proper pencil won't see. He grabs his kite and turns to leave, then stops a moment and looks at me. "Do you want me to teach you how to read the words in the storybook?" he says. "I do." I don't dare admit how much. "Yes," I say, my eyes still fixed on my notebook. "Yes, I do." "Okay, then," he says. "I'll give you a lesson when I get home from school tomorrow." And then he is gone, leaving me to consider how long it has been since a tomorrow meant anything to me. What I learned today. When the David Beckham boy came home from school today, he threw his backpack in the corner, kissed his mother, played with his sister, and then sat down and taught me a few important things. I learned that there are two languages here, Hindi and English. I learned that Hindi is not too different from my native tongue. I learned the Hindi words for girl, boy, and how are you today? More words. Today, the David Beckham boy taught me some more words. Now I can say sit, walk, book, bowl, good, bad, happy, and sad. I learned some sentences too. My name is Lakshmi. I am from Nepal. I am 13. I also learned that the David Beckham's boy is Harish. David Beckham, it seems, is some kind of god. Two worlds. Today, the TV will not work, and the girls beg Monica and Shilpa to tell us a movie. Monica seems vexed by this request, but it is an act, Shahana tells me. Monica loves the movies more than anything in the world. And so we sit at Monica's feet as she tells us about a wealthy bride who opposed the marriage her parents had arranged. The bride ran off to a festival and fell in love with a handsome boy. They sang and danced and ran in and out of the rain until the bride's father found her and dragged her home. The day of the wedding, the bride cried bitter tears as a guest threw marigolds at her feet. The groom rode into the wedding tent on a white horse, and still the bride wept until she saw that it was the boy from the festival. And they sang and danced with the mother and father to celebrate the happy love match. The other girls have 100 questions. How do they make it rain in a movie? How many marigolds did they use? 100? 1,000? Did the horse wear a saddle of gold? I have only one question. How do Monica and Shilpa know about the movies? I whisper to Shahana. Sometimes Mumtaz lets the good-earning girls go to the movies, she says. They don't run away? Shilpa is here of her own choice, says Shahana. She has no debt to Mumtaz. She can leave any time she likes. I don't understand. Her mother was in this business and now she is in the business. It is the family trade. And Monica? Monica is going home in a month or so. But still, she could run away before paying off her debt, I say. They say Monica has a child at home, Shahana says. If she runs off, Mumtaz will take the child. What would Mumtaz want with a child? She will maim it, cut off a hand, a foot, and sell it to a beggar woman, she says. Soft-hearted people will give an extra rupee or two if you have a sick baby. And so I consider a world so ugly that a child would be maimed for life to fetch an extra rupee or two. And another world full of brides and marigolds, rain machines and white horses. The street boy. Other than the old vegetable peddler, the street boy who sells tea from a wire caddy is the only visitor who comes here during the day. He has barely a whisker on his face, and he is skinny and dirty, but the girls tease him and flirt with him and tell him they will trade him kisses for tea. He flirts and jokes in return, but never goes to their beds. I am watching his antics today when he turns to me. "Why do you never buy my tea?" he asks in my language. I am too shy to answer. If I weren't, I would tell him that I am saving all my money so that someday I can go home. But I am ashamed to have this boy from my country see me in this shameful place, and so I flee the room and say nothing. What I learned today. My notebook is nearly full. There are the old equations that my mountain teacher gave me. There are the odd new words I learned on my journey with Uncle Husband. There are pages of calculations showing my debt to Mumtaz and my earnings so far. And now there are pages full of the Hindi and English words Harish has taught me. Beautiful words like candy, bread, cricket, pen, crayon, dress, bracelet, radio, chicken, cow, cartoon, and remote control. Shahana comes in and sees me writing in my notebook. "Don't let Mumtaz or Shilpa see you with that," she says. "If they find out you can read and write, they will think you are planning to escape." I nod. "And then they will put you back in a locked-in room." Shilpa's secret. Today, on my way to the kitchen, I pass by the counting room and see Shilpa buying a bottle of liquor from the street boy. Her hands are trembling as she gives him the money. She swallows half the bottle in one long gulp, then tells the boy to be on his way. He looks at me with furtive eyes as he runs past, and when Shilpa sees me watching, she spits at me and tells me to mind my own business. Later, I ask Shahana why Shilpa would drink that hateful liquid. "She likes it," she says. I don't understand. Her mother gave it to her when she was young, so it would not hurt so much when she was with a customer. She says she used to hate it, but now she likes it too much. How are you today? Whenever Harish sees me, he says in the new language I'm learning, "How are you today?" I reply, "Fine, thank you. And you?" I love the way these new words feel in my mouth, even if they are not true. A strange vocabulary. Now Harish is teaching me American words from a new storybook. The book was a present from a white woman who runs a special singing and playing school where Harish goes on Saturdays. He says the American lady is kind. He says Anita is wrong about the Americans, that they do not shame the children of the brothels. He says this is a story Mumtaz has told her to keep her from running away. I do not know which of them to believe. But I do know from this storybook that this America is a strange place. Everyone there is as rich as a king. The birds there are big as men. They eat a sweet treat made from snow. And the children play the kicking game with a black and white ball like the one on TV. This is the David Beckham game, Harish says. These are the American words I can say. Big bird, Elmo, ice cream, soccer. Don't cross the cook. Today I learn a new Hindi sentence. Don't cross the cook or she will spit in your soup. Harish says this with a very serious face, and at first I don't recognize the word cook. So he uses his hands to make a stirring gesture. I still don't get the meaning. And so he draws the shape of a fat-bottomed woman in his notebook. Then he jumps up, puffs out his stomach and stomps around the room, his skinny little boy legs pounding out a perfect imitation of her thundering walk. "Cook!" I cry out at last. Harish throws back his head and laughs. And I laugh too. It is strange to laugh after all these months, odd and unfamiliar, but somehow not hard at all. An accidental kindness. The man who came to my room today was not like the others. He was young and clean and gentle. He did not simply stand and zip his trousers when he was finished, or fall heavily asleep on top of me the way some do. He didn't fix his hair in the mirror and walk out without a word. He held me. Perhaps it was an accident, or perhaps he forgot where he was, imagining for a moment he was with his sweetheart. But I could feel myself, my true self, give in to the simple pleasure of being held. His body warmed mine the way the Himalayan sun warms the soil. His skin was soft, like the velvet of Tali's nose, and his contentment soaked through to me like an evening rain shower. And so I held him too. Slowly I put my arms around him and allowed them to stay. Eventually we pulled apart. I was the last to let go. He stood and looked at me with something like shyness. "Thank you," he said. Harish had taught me how to say thank you in his language, but it seemed a paltry word for my debt to this man. Am I pretty? In the days after the hugging man leaves, I consider myself in the mirror. My plain self, not the self wearing lipstick and eyeliner and a filmy dress. Sometimes I see a girl who is growing into womanhood. Other days I see a girl growing old before her time. It doesn't matter, of course, because no one will ever want me now. Not counting. It has been 12 days since the hugging man came. I have decided to stop counting the days until he comes back. Understanding Monica. Everyone here is afraid of Monica's temper. When the cook put a sad song on the music machine, Monica yanked on her braid until she turned it off. When Anita asked if it was true that she had a child back home, Monica pinched her ear until she howled. And when Shahana entered her room without permission, Monica threw a pair of shoes at her. But Monica is also given to strange fits of kindness. Once, when the dirty hands doctor pushed himself up against me in a back hall, Monica pried him off of me and told him he would have to pay like everyone else. And the other day she gave Anita a bottle of nail polish, saying she wouldn't need it when she goes home next month. And so, when I see her watching TV alone, I slip into the room and sit silently nearby, wondering which Monica she is today. She regards me, then lights a cigarette.
You know how to write, don't you?
I do. At home, such a skill is something to boast about. But as Shahana has told me, here it is a dangerous thing to admit.
My little girl can write, she says. I am paying her school fees.
So it is true, the rumor of Monica's child.
I paid for her medicine, Monica says,
thrusting her pointy chin in the air.
And for an operation for my father, and for a pair of spectacles for my sister.
I raise my chin, too.
I am buying a new roof for my family, I say.
Monica exhales.
They will thank us, she says. They will thank us and honor us when we go home.
I dare not picture this, a date so far away that it is like a dream.
My sister wrote and said my little girl hates porridge, Monica says.
I try to picture this, a feisty little Monica.
I bet she pinches your sister when she tries to make her eat it, I say.
Monica looks surprised, then she laughs and pinches my ear, ever so slightly, and we go back to watching a TV world full of brides and white horses. A gift.
Today, Harish tells me, is a festival of brothers and sisters. He shows me the rag doll he is giving to Gina. I bought it with my own money, he says.
Then he hands me a pencil. It is shiny yellow and it smells of lead and rubber and possibility.
For you, he says.
And then he runs off, his paper kite in his hand. And I am glad because something strange is happening, something surprising and unstoppable. A tear is running down my cheek. It quivers a moment on the tip of my nose, then splashes onto my skirt, leaving a small dark circle. I have been beaten here, locked away, violated 100 times and 100 times more. I have been starved and cheated, tricked and disgraced. How odd it is that I am undone by the simple kindness of a small boy with a yellow pencil.
Something for the David Beckham boy.
The next day I am at the window waiting for Harish to return from school. I see him coming down the lane, playing make-believe soccer with a tin can. I tap on the window pane, and a few minutes later I hear him bounding up the steps. He walks into our room, and I offer him my gift. It is a ball of rags, my old homespun shawl, ripped into shreds and tied in a tight round bundle. He is puzzled at this bundle of ragged cloth.
A soccer ball, I tell him.
He takes the ball of rags and balances it on his toe. He nods his approval. He nudges it around the room, then gives it a good solid kick toward the doorframe. He spreads his arms wide like a bird in flight and calls back a quick thank you over his shoulder. Then he is gone. I hear the front door close, and I run to the window to watch him turn into a barefoot David Beckham, dodging shoppers and rickshaws as he heads down the lane. I follow him with my eyes for as long as I can. A piece of me has left Happiness House. Still not counting. It has been 30 days since the hugging man came. I have decided that he is not coming back. When Monica left, she gave away all her makeup and fancy baubles. She even gave Shahana the shoes she'd thrown at her. She came to my room to say goodbye, but I hid under the blanket, feigning sleep, so she would not see the envy in my heart. After she left, I found the movie magazine she'd left on my pillow. That afternoon, the cook put a sad song on the music machine. And we who remain at Happiness House listened all the way through to the end, too unhappy for tears. Sorry. By the time Harish comes home today, the sun has set, and it is already time for me to go to work. But he takes a minute to teach me two new words before going up to the roof to fly his kite. The first word is marbles. He holds out his hand and shows me the colorful glass balls. He explains, I think, that he was late for our lesson because he was playing marbles with his friends at the American Lady School. The other word is sorry. He says he's very sad that we can't have our lesson today. This, he said, is what sorry means. I ruffle his hair and tell him not to be sad. Anyway, I say, today my head aches too badly to have a lesson. The cost of a cure. I lie on my cot, drenched in sweat, struggling to wake up. I slip into a dream, and Geeta and I are playing the hopping-on-one-leg game in the dirt path between our huts. She bends, scoops a stone up from one of the squares we've drawn with a stick, then she skips away, her long black braid swinging side to side, in time with her sing-song chant. She turns back and beckons me to follow her. But somehow, she's turned into Auntie Bimla, singing the same song through black-stained teeth. I open my eyes and see the place where I live now, a dank room with four beds, four dirty curtains hanging from the ceiling, and iron bars on the windows. Now I am shaking with cold. I pull the thin sheet around my shoulders, but the trembling goes on. I burrow against the wall, hugging myself, and soon I am sweating again. It has been like this since last night, sleeping, then waking, fever, then chills, each one in a battle for my body. Now Harish in his David Beckham shirt is standing over me. He puts his hand on my brow. If I could speak, I would beg him to stay with me forever, his cool, cool hand on my forehead. But he disappears, and I am dreaming again, of flying on the wings of his kite, high above the snowy, swallow-tailed peak, while he is on the ground below, letting out more and more string, more and more, until he is just a tiny speck. An angry voice brings me back down to earth. It is Mumtaz.
Faker, she says. Get out of bed.
I open my eyes and see her standing over me, with Harish next to her, shaking his head. He puts his hand on my brow again and tells Mumtaz something that makes her frown. She waves a hand at him, like she is swatting at a mosquito, and sends him away.
Have you been washing yourself? She says. After the men, do you wash yourself down there?
I try to nod, but my head is heavy, achy, a distant thing I cannot control. All I can do is close my eyes. Now I am in another bed. A kindly woman in white leans over me, swabbing my head with a cool rag. She tells me she will bring me some of the sweet American treat made from snow. Then she disappears. Now I am climbing out the window of this new place, sneaking through the streets in my nightdress, past the peanut vendor, past the children playing ball, past the women shopping for fabrics, past the mongrel dogs sniffing through the trash, until I am running, running, running toward home.
Here, says a voice, take these.
I open my eyes. Mumtaz is standing over me. Mumtaz, with her plump mango face, has taken the place of the kindly woman in white, and she is holding out a pair of white pills. I understand, then, that the woman and her cool cloth and the snowy treat and the running were all a dream. Mumtaz lifts my head from the pillow, places the pills on my tongue, then brings a glass of water to my lips. I swallow, and for a moment I love her. I love her like a mother, for giving me the medicine that will stop the fever and the sweating and the chills and the shaking. I love her for not throwing me out on the street, for caring for me. I reach out to thank her, but she is bustling around, putting two more pills on the table next to my bed, refilling my glass of water.
Take these pills tonight, she says, and you'll be back at work in no time.
Then she unwinds her waistcloth and takes out her record book. She wets her pencil with the tip of her tongue and writes a number in her book.
You'll be able to work off the cost of the medicine in a few days, she says.
And then she is gone. And try as I might, I cannot bring back my dreams. an old woman. A few days later, when I'm finally strong enough to get out of bed, I pass by a mirror. The face that looks back is that of a corpse. Her eyes are empty. She is old and tired, old and angry, old and sad, old, old, 100 years old. I speak to her in the words Harish taught me. "My name is Lakshmi," I tell her. "I am from Nepal. I am 13 years old. The Living Dead. Today, at the morning meal, an unfamiliar figure is at the table, hunched over a bowl, picking at her rice. She looks up, and I see that it is Monica. "Well," she says with strange cheer, "my father recovered from his operation." Her smile is wide, too wide, and I am afraid of her angry happiness. "He needs a cane," she says, "but he is still as strong as a goat." I nod slowly, unsure what to say. "Look," she says. She shrugs off her shawl, revealing arms and shoulders covered in angry purple bruises. "He did this with his cane." I wince. But Monica laughs bitterly. "I don't understand." "I thought you said they would honor you and thank you," I say. She snorts. "When they heard I was coming," she says, "they met me outside the village and begged me not to come back and disgrace them." "Did you get to see your daughter?" I say. Monica cannot meet my eyes. "They told her I was dead." Beyond words. Pushpa has been in bed for 3 days and nights, and now Mumtaz is in our room. "If you don't get out of bed and see customers today," she says, "you are out on the street." Pushpa nods, stands slowly, then sinks to her knees. She kisses Mumtaz's feet. "Please," she begs, "I'll work tonight, I promise." Then she is seized by one of her coughing fits. She coughs until tears run down her cheeks and she spits blood into a rag. "Psht," Mumtaz says. "You are of no use to me now. No man wants to make love to walking death." "Have mercy," Pushpa cries, holding her hands up in prayer. "Think of my children." Mumtaz sneers at her. Then all at once her eyes begin to gleam like new rupee coins. "There is something you could do," Mumtaz says. Pushpa looks up expectantly. "Sell her to me." She points to little Gina, asleep in her bedroll. "In a few years, when she is old enough, I can make a lot of money with her." Pushpa seems not to understand. "There are men who'd pay dearly," Mumtaz says, "to be with a pure one. Men who think it will cure their disease." She puts a hand on Pushpa's slender shoulder and smiles. Then comes an unearthly sound. It is a wild sound, an animal sound, a howling, mournful, raging cry as the sickly woman on the floor claws at the skirts of the fat woman standing over her. It is a sound beyond language. What despair looks like. For the rest of the afternoon, Pushpa sits on her bed with her head in her hands. Shahana tries to comfort her, but Pushpa stares into space, unmoving. Finally, she rises, tucks a blanket under Gina's chin and whispers to her. "Don't worry," she says. "I will not let that woman take you." Then Harish comes home from school, flushed and disheveled from his game of make-believe soccer. He beams at his mother, delighted to see her out of bed, then stops as he takes in her misery. Neither one says a word. Harish simply pulls his little tin trunk out from under the bed, and the two of them begin packing their things. A word too small. I look on, speechless, as Harish ties up his bedroll and Pushpa places her possessions, a hairbrush, a sweater, a photo of her husband, inside Harish's trunk. Anita is sitting on the bed, clutching Gina to her breast, the two sides of her poor, lopsided face matched for once in perfect misery. Finally, Anita kisses the top of the baby's head, hands her to Pushpa, then runs from the room, sobbing. Harish looks up at me.
How are you today, Lakshmi? He says.
The words are the same as always, but his little boy voice breaks as he says my name. I am not fine. I cannot pretend. But I do not know a word big enough to hold my sadness. I bite my lip and shrug. Harish looks away, then goes back to his packing. Where will you go? I say. I will ask the lady teacher from America if she knows a place we can stay until my mother is better, he says. Until then, I must earn the money. He places his rag bundle soccer ball inside the trunk, snaps it shut. I've heard they pay children 50 rupees a week, he says, to break stones at the roadside.